Well, we have a terrific guest tonight. His name is Ernie Gallo. He was one of the members aboard the USS Liberty, and I want to welcome Ernie to Tour of Duty. Ernie, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome, and thank you for putting some time aside for us. Well, I guess we'll hit the road hard, and we'll hit it fast. We had Gary on with us about a week ago when we're trying to save our Friday night for the USS Liberty. And I guess we can start off with, tell us a little bit about, you know, your job, who you are, and what you were doing on the USS Liberty.
Well, I was a new electronic technician, and I was a communications technician, M branch, maintenance branch. And my reason for being there was to maintain the communications, I should say, the security group communications equipment that was installed on the ship. I was a petty officer, second class, and I was there to make sure that everything was functioning.
Ernie, so were you actually a part? You were a part of the you are in the Navy, correct?
Yes, I was.
I guess the reason I ask that is because I look at some of these I guess you call them their ranks. What does the CTC stand for?
CT is Communication Technician, and it's a group that was which identified you as part of the Naval Security Group.
That's the first time I'd ever crossed that, but okay. Here's one of the big things that I didn't overlook it. I was saving it for the future. What was the actual mission of the USS Liberty in general?
The Liberty was a clandestine intercept ship. We basically sailed up and down the west coast of Africa. Receiving anything that we could in the local frequencies that we encountered. But our primary purpose was that we had the ability to intercept missile launches and recoveries. At that time, the Soviets did not encipher their telemetry, and we could intercept that and record it and send it back to NSA. For posterity.
Okay, now, one of the things that I was kind of curious about, now, this ship, being an intelligent ship, was it armed with any kind of weapon systems on it?
No, we were very lightly armed. We had 4 50 caliber machine guns that were installed in little nests, two on the bow and 2 amidships. They were there just for a repel border situation. Nothing, we were not an aggressive ship whatsoever.
Okay, now, being on the coast over there in the, I guess that was during that 6-day war, specifically, where were you located at with the special mission you guys were doing? I assume you were on a special mission.
Richard, I'm having a very difficult time hearing you.
Okay, let's try this. Can you copy me now?
Yeah.
Were you in a special mission there in 1967?
Well, we were there to monitor the war. Our primary mission would have been to intercept UHF-VHF communications, which is line of sight. And that's why we were about 13 miles off the coast of Egypt, around Port Said. We were just electronic dig ear, listening to anything that we could pick up, but especially the UHF-VHF communications.
And can you say, did you hear anything you weren't supposed to hear?
Well, that I can't address because I was not partial to what was picked up. I don't think there's anything left or anything that remains because the area that where that would have gone to was the area in the ship where the torpedo had blown apart and disintegrated anything that was there.
Oh, like that I did not know. Now, as far as the data that was collected then, during that time, what happens to it? How did it, does it go from one, from your ship to someplace, or?
Well, at the time, the Navy and, as well, the military had relay bases scattered around the world. And we would send whatever information that we could identify to break back. We had linguists on board, and we would encipher the text and send it back via radio teletype, which is a certain spectrum of a certain radio frequency spectrum. But in addition to that, we had this marvelous system called, which was brand new. It was one of the exciting things for me as a new technician, called Moon Bounce. And we had the ability to bounce a signal off the moon, since we didn't have geosynchronous satellites at the time. And we would, for a 5-hour period, we could communicate with Maryland.
So you actually sent the signal and bounced it off the moon?
Yeah. And we had two channels of 100 words a minute traffic, that we could send and receive, yes.
Well, I guess our technology at that time was pretty, I guess you could say it was pretty up to date or beyond.
Well, it was pretty unique. I mean, this was an idea that it was, they first tried it out on some gun mounts, old gun mounts that, and installed a dish onto it, and a couple of fellows kept the antenna trained onto the moon as best they could. But, I mean, our system was automatic. When you say technology, this was analog computers, motors,
yeah,
that would track the moon based on on the information that we read into the machines. But it did a very good job, and of course, the yaw and pitch of the ship was fed also into the computer, and so the 16-foot dish was able to pretty much stay right on the moon up to 13-foot squalls and communicate with Maryland.
I guess you could say that was an old-style GPS then, huh?
Yeah, sure was.
Okay, let's kind of switch gears here. There's been a lot of books written about what happened out there, and most of the crew feel that Jim Ennis's book, who wrote Assault on Liberty, has the best book. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the research that was done about that Six-Day War and the USS Liberty?
Well, Jim Ennis did a fantastic job of, and I understand he's going to be on one of your future programs. He spent a number of years researching and pulling together all the data that he could get his hands on, including a lot of material from the Johnson Library, and some of the items that he acquired were very interesting. He put together the sequence of events as best he could before the incident and then afterwards, and tried to identify as much as he could within the bounds of obtaining this information properly through the Freedom of Information Act directives, and did a great job of identifying the nuts and bolts of the incident.
Okay, let's talk about something specific then. The message that you apparently sent to the NSA by this moon transfer, I'll call it. Was the Liberty ordered to continue? Was it ordered to pull back? Was it ordered to take a closer look? How did all that work out?
Well, the message that you're talking about, which was ordering us to pull back, was Murphy's Law at its finest. This message was put together in Washington, D.C., and the first place it went to was the Philippines. who knows why. And then it was realized it was misrouted, and the calamity continued. We normally sailed directly under NSA's direction or via the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and now that we were entering into the Mediterranean, all of that got confused because now we came under the control of Admiral McCain, who sits in London, and all the hierarchy as it said down to the Sixth Fleet. So the message was never received it. It was sent to all these crazy places. But more importantly, I'd like to talk about why that message was sent. Because according to two individuals, one of which a book called Taking Sides by Stephen Green, and then in a sworn affidavit by Don Cook, both these individuals found out that the Israelis had told the White House that the USS Liberty needed to be pulled out of there or they were going to attack it. Don Cook says it happened twice. According to Stephen Green, the chief of station in Tel Aviv, CIA chief of station in Tel Aviv, sent a message to the NSA telling them that this was going to happen, and this was sent on the 5th of June. And so that was the alarm bell, you might say, that these people were talking about attacking us if the ship wasn't moved. It wasn't pulled back out of there.
Well, so how long was it before you got the message then?
We never received it. They were desperately trying to get the message to us, but by that time the Israelis had started attacking us. It's too late.
Well, and I got another question about this attack. So the attack actually started before you could actually get that information or receive that information, or would that have mattered?
Well, I guess if we were steaming away from the area that we were operating, which was about 13 miles, as I said, off the coast of Saïd, let's say headed out to sea, maybe the Israelis would have thought differently. But since we weren't making any move to leave, I guess they fulfilled what they said they were going to do.
You know, I know this is one of those hypothetical questions, but I got to ask it. We both agree that the Israeli Air Force and their Navy both knew that it was an American ship. What was their mindset was by attacking it? I mean, they must have had a reason for attacking an American ship. Any thoughts on that? Or have you ever even given it any thought? No, I know you have.
Well, in fact, our captain once shared some thoughts with our chief engineering officer, where he suggested that the Israelis would wanted to possibly sink the ship with all hands lost, and of course, since we were off the coast of Egypt, everyone would have thought that it was the Egyptians, and it was. We believe part of a overall plan. I don't really believe, at least I don't want to even conceive, that just like the Tonkin Gulf resolution or Tonkin Gulf incident, where Johnson was managed to convince Congress to increase the number of military in Vietnam, that this was now another attempt. So I want to think that maybe it was supposed to be a fictitious attack, that possibly the Israelis decided, well, they had nothing to lose to actually make it happen. There's another, according to this Don Cook, he claims that from a report that he transcribes that that the Israelis believe, they suspected that we were sharing intelligence with both Israel and the Egyptian government, playing both sides against the middle, and that's the reason that they told, you know, they asked to have the ship moved, and it didn't happen, so they attacked us. And it was, since the attack was so vicious and for so long, it's obvious to us, with over 820 holes or penetrations in the ship, that they were trying to do their best to see us sink. And through the grace of God, it did not happen.
Well, how long did the actual, let's call it the from the start to finish, or to the attack actually go on?
Well, at the time, it seemed like forever. But I guess
I'm
it was
sure
about...
that I can relate with.
I guess it was about 90 minutes. So it wasn't something that you know, that someone accidentally, as they say, the Israelis say it was an accident that they, you know, like it's one jet firing on us, there's, you know, three to four jets that was trying to, that were putting rockets into us and napalm, and doing what they could to make sure that there was no activity topside, while three torpedo boats arrived to not only shoot the ship up as best they could, but they also put a torpedo in the side of us, and that killed 26 of our crewmen.
That is sometimes just hard to... I won't get into all that. Now, as far as the survivors and a few of the noteworthy government officials and naval officers that claimed the attack, we've been talking about the deliberate attack on this. Now, what was your part during the 67-day war? What part did you play in this? Was there a part?
Well, as I said earlier, our mission was to intercept basically whatever we could in the UHF-VHF region. And as a matter of fact, our captain and the chief of our security group, Dave Lewis, had a conversation before the event, and the captain was concerned, and he was he didn't want to be so close to shore. And Dave Lewis, performing his duties as best he could, was advising the captain that since it's line-of-sight communications, that we needed to be that 13 miles as our orders, which had been written, placed us.
And before I forget, for those of you who are listening to this incredible story, if you'd like to get updates on the USS Liberty, go to their website, usslibertycom.org. And there's actually two or three different sites you can go to, but USS.org is the one that's actually sponsored by the crew. And there's also a $10,000 reward that you need to look into. Now, another tough question. What do you know of the Frontlet 615 and Operation Cyanide?
Well, these are two documents that is really amazing. We... Jim Ennis and his research with the Johnson Library pulled up a document that, and this document was written, I believe, in May, 2 months before, 1 month before the attack occurred, and it talked about plans. What I'm saying is, and we speculate because we've tried to get the copies of these two operational plans, and we have been denied. We've been denied them. But these were plans that we had put together with Israel before the Six-Day War. We believe Frontlet 615 was the date 615. was the date that the Six-Day War, as we call it now, was scheduled to begin. We also know that we were militarily involved in that war, and I'm not saying in a fighting capacity, but in a support capacity. And this is what these documents describe. It was at such a level that the 303 Committee, which is a senior group, that the whole reason for it is to protect the president if a clandestine mission went wrong. And it's made up of State Department, CIA, National Security Agency, to make sure that the president doesn't look bad if a clandestine situation went bad.
Freddie, we're going to take a break right now, and I hear my airstrike come in. We'll be back in just a couple minutes. Ladies and gentlemen, this is our Sergeant Richard Cabral on tour of duty with my guest, Ernie Gello, U.S. of Liberty. We'll be right back. Hey, this is Richard Cabral, back on tour of duty with my guest, Ernie Gello, one of the crew members of the USS Liberty. Ernie, let's pick it up where we left off. And I'm just going to let you run with the end of the... We were talking about the plan, I believe.
It's been very difficult getting any further information from our sources, I guess they can say still consider these two documents to be classified, and obviously it would not look good, I guess, if the Arab countries knew that we were assisting the Israelis. However, at the time, we can't forget that the Soviets were busily doing the same thing with Syria and Egypt. I mean, Egypt was practically a client of the Soviets, and what can I say? Their hands were as dirty as ours.
Well, let me ask you something. You said something about the 303 Committee and the senior group. Who actually was that again?
The Director of Central Intelligence, someone from the State Department. I don't remember all of the participants, but they were at that level to continually review and monitor whatever clandestine operation was going on, so that if it went wrong, the president would be protected.
Gotcha. Okay, now for a really tough question, and the word that always shakes people up is when we talk about cover-up. Now, apparently there was a cover-up between done by Johnson and McNamara. Can you extrapolate on that?
Well, we were told after the attack that we were never to speak of the incident to anyone, including our families, and that if anybody asked us any questions, we were to direct them to the proper authorities, in the Navy, and that we were basically, given this oath that we never divulge anything about the Six-Day War.
So that's all classified stuff.
Well, there's been many books written about the Six-Day War now.
Yeah.
Everything that I have said, and I will say, I believe has been declassified because it's information that we've acquired through the many books and FOIA requests that we have put in and received. Now, in your last broadcast with Gary, he was talking about Admiral Kidd and the JAG captain,
Ward Boston.
And Ward Boston came out of the closet, and he said, yes, there was a cover-up. He was ordered to change the Naval Court of Inquiry details so that it mirrored the Israeli claim that it was an accident. So things like a flag that the Israelis said they never saw the United States flag, that sort of thing, and that he is now saying that it was deliberately done against all forms of Navy tradition and honesty. You might say his testimony is a smoking gun. Okay?
So that was, I guess you could say, when he came out of the closet, he's telling the American public the truth.
And just recently, to support his statement, because there, Judge Crystal has accused him of lying, okay? Just recently, out of the clear blue sky, from an earlier FOIA request that we had put in, we got a message that was declassified that was sent on the 15th of June from Admiral McCain's office in London to Navy headquarters, okay? And Admiral Kidd and Captain Ward Boston left the Liberty and went to London to provide the details to Admiral McCain. Now, even though the Court of Inquiry that was published was different, this message identifies specifically the information, the things that were presented to the court by the crew and taken with them, so that they knew from the sequence of events. Anybody with any that has a head on their shoulders is going to understand that it could not have been an accident, that it was deliberate. You don't spend 90 minutes trying to sink the ship, and it was that's an accident. Why bother? Why waste 820 some bullets, rockets, torpedoes to simply shoot up the ship? Doesn't make sense. So now we have both. We have Ward Boston and now this cable that clearly indicates that there was a cover-up that took place.
Now, when you said Admiral McCain, would that be the father of John McCain?
Yes.
POW pilot?
Yes. He was the commander of the entire North Atlantic and that part of the world. I'm not sure exactly where those lines were drawn, but I mean, the Sixth Fleet was under his command, and anything that happened in Europe and Mediterranean.
Okay, we'll go come fast forward now. Sometime in the spring of 2004, the State Department apparently held a convention to discuss the events of the Six-Day War. Did they invite you to this? Were the members of the crew invited? Is that something that is done by law, or what's all that about?
Okay. We were invited to attend, but we were not part of the discussion group. The discussion group was made up of a panel, I believe, of about, I think, 6 to 8 people. And these were historians from the State Department. In fact, the historian who provided the organization for the discussion was Mark Susser, his guests included people from, well, within the State Department and also from the Central Intelligence Agency, and authors that were known for their supposedly accurate reporting of the Six-Day War. And I say it that way because one of the folks that were invited was this Judge Crystal, who is, as far as we're concerned, is an Israeli apologist.
So didn't he write a book?
Yes. And he supposedly he studied the incident, the Liberty incident, and concluded that the Israelis are right; it was an accident. It's funny that. Anyway, let me continue on about this State Department effort.
I didn't want to interrupt you there. Go ahead.
But I guess every so often, when there is a contentious subject matter, the State Department will review that incident and supposedly clear the air by reporting everything that they could find out about it, declassifying as much as they can, and so that the truth prevails. Well, I'm telling you, as I said before, none of the crew was invited to speak. The only person that did us any help at all was Jim Bamford, who wrote Body of Secrets and a number of great books. In fact, Jim Bamford read the sworn testimony of Ward Boston to indicate that the attack was deliberate and it was covered up. They even had, I believe, two individuals from Israel, believe it or not. And it was a farce. It was an absolute farce. Mark Susser spent a good 15 minutes talking about the law and how they were, you know, that they're this effort was to make sure that everything that could be said is said and clear the air. Well, that's not what happened. It was more of the same garbage, and the cover-up continued. Afterwards, the floor was open for comments, and then one of our individuals got up to speak, and basically was shouted down, and they turned the mic off. They don't want to hear from us. They don't want to be told that they're lying.
Well, it's a sad state of affairs for this whole incident. Listen, Ernie, I'm going to take one more break, and then what we're going to do is we'll finish up. Talking about some of the things that we may have overlooked, and then we'll talk about the Veterans Organization, all right?
Okay.
Sergeant Richard Cabral on Tour of Duty. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back. This is Sergeant Richard Cabral on Tour of Duty. My guest today is Ernie Gallo. He is a member of the USS Liberty back in 1967 when the ship was attacked by the Israeli Air Force and Navy. Ernie, thank you again for being with us. Is there anything that we may have overlooked, maybe not talked about, discussed, some other highlight or points that you'd like to make?
Well, I'd like to explain to your listening audience what we're all about. I'd like to explain that why, after 38 years, we're still in there. No, we had 34 of our shipmates killed, 172 wounded of the crew, and the 34 shipmates, if we did nothing, if we just simply let the thing go, they would have died in vain. We're not going to let that happen. We refuse to. They did die, and it's been the purpose, and the purpose is that the truth of what happened be told by and to the American public. Receive all the details about what happened during that six-day war. I mean, I know I said some pretty outlandish things that our hands were dirty in the six-day war and so on, but can you imagine if the American public knew the details that how they might feel about the Middle East today? It's important that they know how we have got ourselves entrenched with in the Middle East and in the Israeli government. President Eisenhower one time got upset with the Israelis and told them at a face-to-face meeting, and he said, you're going to lose our support if you don't behave. I just wonder if President Eisenhower was around today, what would he think of the situation as it is now, and how the Israelis treat the Palestinians? I just want everybody to know, we're not a bunch of crazies. We're not a radical group. We're a lot of law-abiding citizens. We will always be that way. What we continue to work through the courts and the proper scenarios for collecting data, and we just want the truth told, not only about the liberty but also the Six-Day War. It's important for America to have that information.
You know, I think we touched a little bit about the Six-Day War. In your own, I guess you say your own views, your own feelings about that, what was your take on that Six-Day War?
Well, it reminds me of a discussion with Lieutenant Commander Dave Lewis and a few of my fellow shipmates around a table, and we were looking at a map, and he was pointing out to us that this country called Israel was just overwhelming its neighbors and leveling their military. And we were just so happy to hear that we were on their side. Keeping in mind the Cold War situation and whatever insecurities there might be, that we were out there by ourselves with no but any way to shoot back or protect ourselves, and that if we got into any trouble, that we can depend on our ally, Israel, to help us out. And as a matter of fact, during the attack, I was below decks and at my general quarters place, and I had no idea that it was the Israelis that was causing all this commotion. Had no idea that they were the ones who had put a torpedo on their side. The whole time I was thinking it was the Egyptians. It wasn't until afterwards, when I came topside, that we found out, that my group found out, that it was indeed the Israelis. And we could not believe it. We could not believe it. They had us under observation for days. In fact, the day before, I was topside, and the plane came by so close that you could see the pilot, and I waved to him, and he waved back. They couldn't understand why it happened, because they knew who we were.
You know, looking at your website, you have got it's a great website, first of all, and it has tremendous amount of information and books and pictures. And some of the pictures are, you know, graphic. When you get down into where they had where a lot of the guys were wounded. But I got to ask you, of all the books that are on there, in your own, I know you're going to be partial in this, but what books do you think people would need to read to really fill them in on what actually happened there?
Well, John Bourne wrote an outstanding book that's quite details some of the story of what we went through afterwards, it was working towards his history doctorate, and this was his dissertation, and it was published. Called USS Liberty, Descending History versus Official History.
Which is what I have. John did send me one.
I'm sorry?
John Bourne, he sent me one.
Oh, did he?
Probably about 7 years ago. I do have a copy of that.
And, you know, one of the reasons we can keep talking about we want the truth told, he hits the nail right on the head when he says, you know, as he got into this story, and he's going to report the details for historic reasons, what's going to appear in the history books? The lies from the U.S. government or the facts as he has acquired them himself? I mean, independently and objectively, that he could, it was obvious to him that the official word from the U.S. government was incorrect, that they were bold-faced lies. Another book that was written recently called Operation Cyanide by Peter Haunen. I believe that could be obtained on eBay maybe or one of those.
Amazon.com,
thank you. And he's a British author, and he has done, he's interviewed Israelis, he has interviewed McNamara and the director of Central Intelligence at the time, Dick Helms, before he died, and has put together a very interesting book, and it talks about this Frontlook 615 and Operation Cyanide in detail of what he's discovered. And it's, as I just said, it's quite compelling.
Well, I got to say, it's been an eye-opener, not just for me, but I'm sure for a lot of the listeners, about what really transpired during all of this. And I do want to say thank you for your service to our country, not only as a member of the USS Liberty, but in the other job that you worked at. I just wish it was just more that we could do, other than get the word out. It's just something that the pressure from the American public is what it's going to take to get the truth. You know, one last question. Did McNamara ever write a letter or something? I found someplace that he sent some kind of a letter to somebody in apologizing for something, or was that a... Do you know anything about that?
Oh, well, yeah. McNamara wrote, I believe it was a book, about the Vietnam War, apologizing for the Vietnam War. Not about the Liberty, just the Vietnam War. Every time McNamara is asked about the Liberty, he says he knows nothing.
I could have sworn I saw a document someplace with his name and the USS Liberty on it.
Not to my knowledge. As I said, I know he's written a book apologizing for the Vietnam War.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Well, Ernie, I do want to thank you again. We're going to be following up with Jim Ennis, and I do want to get a hold of Jim, and I'd like to get him on this week, mainly because of the time span. I don't want a week to go by, so I'm going to try and get him to follow you up maybe the day after. And I do want to get together with you once we get off the show and get Jim Ennis's information number so that I can contact him.
Okay. It's a pleasure to be on, and I thank you for helping us out. Every little bit helps for us to explain and to provide some, you know, within a limited time period, the details of what we went through and what happened, and it very much affects what's happening to our country today.
Yeah, it's amazing though how you know, things have transpired over the last 38 years between since that incident and the Israeli war and all the things that have happened since then. You'd almost think that the USS Liberty was involved with this small piece of the history of what's going on in Iraq today.
Amen, amen. Although I support our troops and support President Bush, I think we needed to do what we did.
Right. No, I would know this too for me on that. I agree with you 100%.
Yeah. I could go. You're hitting a nerve, and I can go on and on and on about that. But I don't think you want.
Well, go ahead and take a minute.
Well,
open up people's eyes about a couple of things.
ever since the 67 war, we have been we've been allowing the Israelis to do whatever they want. And I'm not saying that the Arabs were very smart in some of the things they did, but I mean, after all, the UN gave them borders, and they decided that's not good enough, and we know what's happened since then, and they have illegally taken over property that doesn't belong to them. And they've killed people at will. There was an American over there, a young gal who was protesting a bulldozer leveling some of the homes over there, and they ran the bulldozer over her, killing her, and no investigation, nothing. In other words, we have given the Israelis a free pass to murder our own citizens. Where does this end?
We're going to get together again, and we're going to talk a little bit more on that. Ernie, thank you again. It was a real honor having you on the show.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure, too.
This is Sergeant Richard Cabral on Tour of Duty. I hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back with Jim Ennis, and you'll be informed when it'll take place. God bless. Have a great week. Bye-bye.